Välkommen till Radio Folkungen den 5 juli 2023. Idag har vi den stora äran att ha överste Douglas McGregor med oss, så det blir på engelska. Han talar visserligen flytande tyska också, men vi bestämde oss för att göra det på engelska. Överste McGregor är en flitig och eftertraktad gäst i poddar och samtal. Han har en syn på Ryssland-Ukraina-kriget som går tvärs emot vad man oftast får höra via skattefinansierade medier. Överste McGregor har en diger meritlista med bland annat följande huvudpunkter. Han är krigsveteran med många utmärkelser, bland annat från krigen i Irak och Kosovo. Han pensionerades år 2004. Han innehar en doktorsgrad i internationella relationer. Han är konsult inom försvar och utrikespolitik. Han har skrivit 5 böcker om nydanande militär organisation. År 2020 utsågs han av president Trump till senior rådgivare till försvarsministern. Ett ämbete han innehade tills Trump avlöstes från presidentposten. Vi är oerhört glada att han idag gästar Radio Folkungen.
Colonel McGregor, very welcome to the Folkungen podcast, where we will talk a little bit about Russia, Ukraine and Sweden and NATO. Are you ready for that?
Absolutely.
So, first question is, who's really behind this war? It's playing out in the Ukraine, but is it really between the Ukraine and Russia?
Well, that's a very good question, because I think you've got to go back over 25 plus years to discover the roots of all of this. And while it was very obvious, certainly by the year 2000, that the continuous expansion of NATO towards the Russian border would be met with extreme concern, if not real hostility, by the Russians. The Ukrainian issue is actually secondary, in my judgment, or even tertiary, to the larger matter of people who seem to be determined to destroy Russia. And that's a minority of these globalist leaders that we have both in Western Europe and at the moment in Washington. Globalist is only a partial description. We also have these people that call themselves neocons or neoconservatives. There's nothing conservative about them, and really there's nothing new about them. They're internationalists with a global military hegemony agenda. And I think these people hijacked control of our foreign and defense policy really in the late 80s, early 90s. This business really got off the ground under Reagan. It was there with President Bush Sr., the first President Bush, but it really came to fruition under Clinton. And there are a couple of things that I don't think most Europeans understand. And that is, at first, most Americans are neither interested in nor pay attention to anything that happens beyond their borders. When I was at Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, I had a Spanish general staff officer who summed it up brilliantly. He said, Colonel McGregor, there's no such thing as the United States as a country. The United States is really a planet. And there's much truth in that statement. So an awful lot of what happens in our foreign and defense policy is of very little interest to the average American. And he takes on faith whatever his government tells him, which is a very bad habit, obviously. One would think that we were smarter, but we're not. And so if people tell us, well, there's a dangerous country here, country X, it's led by evil dictators or dictator, and it must be cleansed of dictatorship and converted to the utopia of liberal democracy, people sort of shrug their shoulders and say, all right, I guess that's necessary. And the lesson of the last 25, 30 years is, if you not take 1,000 casualties in one day, which inevitably wakes up the American people to what's going on, you only take a few casualties every day, or maybe a few hundred every month, you're probably going to be able to get away with whatever you want to do. So that's the key lesson. And part of that lesson is that if you can wage war by exploiting someone else's manpower, then that's even better, because that means that someone else is paying the price in blood, not Americans. Therefore, whatever you do, with money, with equipment, with weapons, once again, evokes very little response from the American people. So part of this is a natural progression to a conflict with Russia, because Russia demonstrated remarkably to the entire world its ability to rapidly recover from total oblivion. If we go back to the 1990s, Russia was in just a horrible, horrible condition. And population was demoralized, its armed forces were in ruins, and people in the West were quite happy. And large numbers of people from New York City and London, financial types, went to Russia with the goal of essentially stealing whatever they could get out of Russia, stripping it of resources, exploiting it, using it, buying up Russians, Russian politicians, oligarchs, and so forth, in order to gain access to the resources in Russia and strip them. All of this was ended by Vladimir Putin, former KGB agent. What a lot of people don't understand is that it, certainly during the Soviet era, the people who understood the most about the West and the most about the world beyond Russia's borders were KGB officers, because they were the select few that could actually travel. And Mr. Putin was an excellent example of that. He did actually spend time in the West. He actually quite pro-German. He speaks excellent German. He likes Germany and he likes the West. And that has been, frankly, a problem for him ever since he came to power in Russia, because there is this long-term strain in Russian thinking that the West is dangerous. The West is disruptive. It's destabilizing. But he's managed to survive all of that. And all through the very beginning of this century, Mr. Putin went out of his way to talk with each American president and with many European leaders, expressing his concern about avoiding a collision with the West by ensuring that the states on Russia's borders were not members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. All of his pleas, all of his questions went unanswered, and ultimately his worst nightmare came to fruition. The first glimmer of what was coming came in Georgia. And that was demonstrated very conclusively by Putin that that would not be tolerated. Even then, I don't think he thought we would do what we've done in Ukraine. Ukraine, of course, is a strange animal, because the construct, this national construct with borders, bears no resemblance to historic Ukraine or to where Ukrainians live. And this is a consequence of border changes that have happened dozens of times over the last 100 years, and probably 100 times over the last 1,000. So there's great confusion about what is really Ukrainian and what isn't. And ultimately, Putin was willing to live with this bizarre construct that placed millions of Russians in eastern Ukraine and Crimea under Western control, provided he could get some sort of assurance that Ukraine would not become a hostile state to Russia, that Ukraine would not become an extension of NATO and therefore a potential launching pad for operations against Russia, economic, military, political, social, and so forth. He watched the color revolutions run by the National Endowment for Democracy and the CIA in various parts of the world. It was very clear to him that that too would pose a threat. Eventually, that's what he saw happen in Ukraine. But there was never any interest on Putin's part, and frankly, no interest in Russia, in this reconstitution of the Soviet Empire. Far from it. If there is a lesson the Russians learned from the Soviet period, it is, look, we don't want to manage these countries. It's an economic losing proposition for us. The populations don't want to be ruled by us. And he's never had any interest in expanding Russia back into Eastern Europe. At the same time, he took the Russian military and made it much smaller. He made it much better. He tried to modernize it and had some success in that department. But just how small the Russian military was, especially the army, became eminently visible to everyone in February 2022. When those first forces that went in, and there were only about 90,000 that went into eastern Ukraine, they performed very, very well. They did not take heavy casualties. They were not destroyed and stopped. The Ukrainians did not obliterate them, but it became very, very clear early on that once there would be no negotiated solution, because there were no partners in the West that would talk to President Putin and come to some sort of arrangement for peace, that what he had was grossly inadequate for operations in a country the size of Texas. And so the decision was made to go to the strategic defense to economize and then build up the force, which has now happened. And today, the Russian military is larger than it's been certainly since the 1980s, and frankly, much more capable, given the various technologies integrated and assimilated into the Russian military. But the notion that there was this quiet, devious plan to march west, overrun Finland, overrun Sweden, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, is all nonsense. There was no capability for it. And frankly, you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, the Russians are incompetent and stupid, can't get anything right. Their force is too small. And then a few months later, Russia always meant to invade and wanted to conquer Eastern Europe. Well, it's a lot of nonsense. It doesn't hold up to closer scrutiny. And then finally, I think we're suffering with the hangover from the Cold War. For 50 years, if you watched any American television, certainly any English-speaking television, you would see that everyone who was Russian or anyone who was bad, quote-unquote, as a spy or something else, spoke with a Russian accent. And you turned on the television in May every year and watched these massive military parades in Red Square. We saw new missiles show up. And people came to the conclusion, you know, the Russians are incurably bad. And even though the Cold War ended, our relations with Russia improved dramatically. And I was part of that. I saw them up close, worked with them, and they did great things for us, particularly when we went into Afghanistan initially. They were very helpful to us. I don't think we could have gone in and accomplished anything without the valuable intelligence that they put. But it didn't make any difference to the elites in Washington who were interested in the same thing that they had been interested in the 1990s. And that was, how do we get at Russia? How do we strip it of its resources? How do we remove the current government and place something there instead that will do our bidding? Because that's effectively what we've managed to do wherever we've spent any time. We've managed to install leaders that were amenable to us, that would cooperate with us. And NATO itself, which was originally designed to be a purely defensive alliance, was transformed in the 1990s into this offensive instrument. And we dragged our European allies kicking and screaming in whatever direction we chose to move. And that was very obvious in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and then subsequently in Kosovo, subsequently in Afghanistan, and then Iraq, and ultimately even in Syria. And finally, Libya. So all of these places have been subject to this enormous pressure that comes from the United States through NATO. And part of that is because, obviously, Europeans have almost no military power. They've largely dismantled their own capability, become entirely dependent upon us. When I was at Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, one of the things that became very clear was that everything relating to command, control, computers, communications, electronics, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, all the space-based, sea-based assets, everything was American. And European forces, even if they decided collectively, well, we don't want the Americans here and we're all going to cooperate, had nothing with which to command, control, and operate their own forces. So this put the Europeans in a difficult position because clearly the European elites were not interested in spending any money on their own defense. And so they couldn't possibly turn around to their populations with these very expensive and luxurious welfare systems with declining workforces that only work 8 hours or not even 8 hours a day or only 6 hours a day or only 30 hours a week and so forth. How do you turn to those electorates and say, well, I'm sorry, we're going to have to cut back on all these luxurious vacation times, all these holidays, and we're going to have to build up our own military capability because it's going to take, you know, at least billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in order for us to have the constellations in space, the command and control structure in order to operate on our own. Nobody wanted to do it. So they decided, well, we'll just go along with Americans and we'll try to limit the damage that we do to ourselves or that the Americans end up doing to us. Well, this is no longer possible. You can't limit it because the United States has dragged Europe right into the combat zone. in Ukraine and made it very clear that we expect Europeans to support this war in Ukraine to the last Ukrainian. In fact, behind the scenes, I think there's been a great deal of pressure to try and get Europeans to provide troops, provide air forces, provide navies to also fight against the Russians on the conventional level. I don't think that's been very successful, but no doubt it has happened. So this brings us to the point where we are now. And Ukraine is about finished. There's not much left. I don't think they have much manpower left. Their press gangs are operating in the far west, trying to drag Ukrainians in the far west and Hungarians that live on Ukrainian soil, for instance, into the Ukrainian army. Obviously, there's not much enthusiasm. At least 12 million people have left Ukraine. Large numbers of single men are continuing to leave. There are trains in Germany every day carrying Ukrainian refugees, and there are huge numbers of single young men. And inside Ukraine itself, we now see that some of these press gangs trying to drag people into the Ukrainian army are being pelted with stones, in some cases, even fired on. We also know that for the first time in great numbers, Ukrainian forces are seeing desertions. But most of these desertions are not simply individuals. They are platoons and companies. And most recently, a Ukrainian commander who had a company and a very, very badly wounded group of people in the company made direct contact with the Russians because he said he could not get the wounded evacuated. The Ukrainian military would not come and get them. And he said, either we sit here and die or we surrender. I've decided to surrender. And remember that most of the forces you're talking about are speaking Russian on both sides. And there isn't very much difference between them. And the Russians very intelligently have always treated Ukrainian soldiers very carefully with great respect. So the Ukrainians know they're not going to be harmed. And as a result, things are just continuing to accelerate in a downward spiral. And against this backdrop, we see all sorts of incredible threats and claims of success and victory coming out of Kiev. Now, I don't know what the news in Sweden says. I know the news is not very helpful in places like France and Germany and the Netherlands. The truth is not popular. But I hope that the Swedes can somehow or another disengage from their television sets and the mainstream media and begin to think carefully about this, because there is no danger from Russia in terms of invading the West. And there's no real reason why the Swedes should become part of an alliance that is unambiguously offensive and committed to Russia's destruction.
Well, there's some head scratching going on here. People are trying to understand, why is this still going on? Why hasn't Ukraine won already? Because that's what we've been told from the beginning, that Russia is converting fridges to bombs, and they're buying breast milk pumps, smuggling them via Georgia to use the electronics for missiles, and they're running out of everything. And yeah, but it's hard to hide the truth forever. So people are starting to wonder what's really going on there. But
yeah. Well, I also think there's this historical backdrop. We can go back to 1709 and the failure of Charles the 12th in the Battle of Poltava, which many of us in the West regret, but he overreached, put himself in a terrible position and lost. And the outcome was the Treaty of Narva in 1720. And there weren't very many people living in the Baltic littoral who were happy to join the Russian Empire. But I would argue that the Tsarist Empire of that era, whatever its faults, was vastly more humane and vastly more positive as a force in Eastern Europe than the Soviets that followed them. And I would argue that today's Russia has much more in common in terms of its values and thinking with the culture and the mentality of Tsarist Russia than it does with the Soviet Union. I don't see any real connection anymore between the Soviet side and modern Russia. So I would simply see Putin in many ways as a contemporary equivalent of a czar, just as I regard President Xi in China as a de facto emperor. And people don't seem to understand that the government in China and the structure of that government and the way things are running is something the Chinese are comfortable with. I also think people don't understand that for the most part, Russians are quite comfortable with what exists today in Russia. Now, that doesn't mean that there is not pressure inside Russia for what I would call more democratization. I think there is, and I think we've already seen that on the battlefield. One of the most interesting aspects of this whole business of democratization in Russia is the instance of Russian soldiers going to their own media and essentially saying, look, we're being commanded by an idiot. This general that took us into this later operation is a fool. Someone needs to get rid of him, or we're going to get more people killed unnecessarily. Well, wonder of wonders, Putin listened. That man was removed. Russian soldiers do have a voice. Russian soldiers are thinking people. They are not the slave army of 1944 and 45 being driven into machine gunner and artillery fire at great cost. Nothing could be further from the truth. And Putin and his generals have been very economical with their soldiers' lives, very concerned about minimizing losses. So I think Russia is fundamentally different. And I would ask everybody in Sweden to begin looking at Russia differently. And this is not to say Russia is a utopian state that everyone should emulate. What I'm saying is that what you have today in Russia is imperfect, just as what we have in the United States is imperfect. But it works for the Russians. And Putin is not some sort of evil incarnate character. If anything, he's done Russia great service, particularly in suppressing much of the corruption that has been choking Russia now for years and eliminating many of the worst oligarchs that were doing the most damage to the Russian people. And once the war is over, I think one of the results of this war will be a more democratized open Russia, because I think the soldiers returning from the battlefield will demand it, because that's what we see evidence for on the battlefield with the Russian army.
What is there something else behind these the warmongers? Is it just a matter of resources, or do we have some values, culture, religion driving this? Some innate hatred for Russia for some reason.
Well, in some cases, these people are descended from families that obviously have a history of hatred or hostility towards Russians. There's no question about that. But I don't think that's the complete explanation. I think that we're dealing with ideologues who became convinced in the aftermath of the Cold War that the United States should not only employ its military power in order to, quote unquote, democratize the world, but that that military power combined with our financial system should be employed to dominate the world. In other words, We began after 1992 to do what the British Empire did after 1815 and the destruction of Napoleon and France. And that was to seek out new frontiers of insecurity. Suddenly, places that were historically of no interest became important. Suddenly, places that were always peaceful were suddenly conflicted. And wherever we saw conflict, wherever we saw crisis, wherever we saw resources and opportunities for profit, I think there was a tendency to expand these frontiers of insecurity. I could not imagine 30, 40 years ago, anyone suggesting for a second that Pakistan is a place of vital strategic interest to the United States. But the same people who want desperately to destroy Russia, to make Ukraine this vassal state of greater American military and political power and economic power, they are also the ones who are now suddenly saying, well, we need to look carefully at Pakistan. We may have to intervene there. Well, that's sheer lunacy. Why would we do such a thing? But then again, the notion that we should be involved in anything that happens in eastern Ukraine is lunacy. We have no real strategic interest other than peace. That's the one interest that we have in eastern Ukraine, because we understand historically, at any rate to this point, every president certainly did up until clearly, I would say, Bush Jr. and then ultimately Obama and his successor now Biden. Trump was the exception, obviously. They began to think in terms of anything that happens anywhere in the world must involve us. It's in our interest to be involved everywhere. In fact, Donald Trump said, no, it is not in our interest to be involved everywhere. And he's one of these people that understood that for thousands of years, the world existed without us. And however much we think we're important and however much we love our own country, we're not necessarily vital to everybody else on the planet. And they can make good decisions or bad decisions on their own. But right now, the leadership in Washington does not share that viewpoint.
How long can the U.S. go on being the world's police, or should I say bully?
I usually answer that by saying, when did the British leave India? And the answer is the British decide to leave India in 1947 when their debt to GDP ratio was 240%. In other words, they were effectively broke. They couldn't sustain themselves anymore. They couldn't afford it. India, the jewel in the crown, if you will, was more of a liability than an asset. And they fought the entire Second World War, not so much to defeat Germany, but to preserve their so-called empire and influence. And ultimately, they lost everything. They ran themselves into bankruptcy, and they won nothing as a consequence. I think we're nearing that point, because what could we possibly win in a war in Eurasia? And the answer is nothing. I mean, Eisenhower, when he was president, ended the war in Korea. But before the war in Korea ended, there were plans to put 800,000 U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula and to march into Manchuria. And Eisenhower looked at these plans and said, whoever put these together should have their heads examined. This is insane. The American people have no interest in waging war in China. Well, he was right. He ended the war. We had no real interest in waging war in Southeast Asia either. I don't see any evidence for any interest in going to war with China anywhere. On the contrary, I think it would be catastrophic for both parties. But there's a certain tendency among these people to be drunk on power and completely arrogant and ignorant, because the people making all these decisions know nothing, nothing about Eastern Europe, nothing about Russia, nothing about Ukraine. You know, it's so sad and tragic that people that know so little exercise so much power and authority. But that's the case. And I leave it to you to tell me how you think the Europeans see things. I used to have greater faith in the Europeans because they lived closer to reality. But today I'm beginning to wonder what's happened. Where are the old elites that understood all the problems that had led to the world wars and were determined to avoid those and were very focused on arrangements that could be reached that would avoid conflict? I keep waiting for them, particularly in Berlin. Haven't seen any.
I think they were destroyed in the First and Great War, most of them. How would you say, at what capacity is the Russian military performing right now? And why aren't they running at 100% and just finishing this business?
From the very beginning, I think that Vladimir Putin has wanted to avoid a direct confrontation with the United States and NATO. And he understands that the decision makers are really in Washington and to a lesser extent in London. And he's wanted to make sure that Russian forces and U.S. forces and other NATO forces do not collide directly. Therefore, he has moved very cautiously and very deliberately. He was concerned, I think, from the very beginning that if he launched a major offensive, not only would it be unnecessarily destructive to Ukraine and to the people living there, but it would also frighten Europeans and frighten the United States into thinking that he is something he's not, and that the Russians are something they are not. They are not interested in a war with the West. I keep telling people, if anything, they want desperately to do business with the West. I have many friends in the private sector, and many of them were actually in Russia working on major business deals when this war began and we began this process of condemning Russia. And when the meetings broke up, all of the Russians sitting across from their American counterparts said, look, let's hope this is over quickly so that we can get back to business. And I think that's been his hope from the beginning. And then the last thing, and this is something we Americans don't understand at all. I think Putin wants Russians to be able to live with Ukrainians and other Europeans after the war is over. In other words, he doesn't want to be dragged into a situation where so much blood is spilled, so much destruction is unleashed, that people for years after the conflict find it impossible to cooperate, impossible to do business with each other. We, on the other hand, seem absolutely determined to permanently poison the waters with Russia, with China, with anybody who supports Russia or is sympathetic to Russia. I think that's catastrophic for our interests, but our interests are not his. They're very different. And that's part of the problem right now. And Putin has taken a long time to discover that, at least for the moment, there is no one for him to talk to. And this leads to the major question. The Russian forces are performing, I would argue, brilliantly at this point. Everything that the Russians have been talking about in military affairs for several decades is coming to fruition. This ISR strike, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and strike network that was first mentioned in the 1970s by Ogarkov and his general staff, that's now finally coming to become a reality. And it's very effective. And they're learning how to integrate their maneuver forces and logistics within this larger strike complex, such that they are inflicting casualties of a rate of 1 to 10 or 1 to 8. And within a sphere of relative invulnerability provided by their own ISR and strike assets. So whatever they do, they will move within that framework. But I think the question is, what can we reasonably expect if we continue on this road? And I don't think they've decided in Moscow. I think there's one party that says, the longer we wait to finish this, the weaker we appear to people in the West. This leads the West to reach stupid conclusions and potentially to take stupid actions and intervene in Western Ukraine. The other party says, well, things are actually moving in our direction. Europe's economies are falling apart. Germany is being systematically deindustrialized, which is something the Russians never wanted. That's harming the EU and harming Europe at large. The populations, the electorates on the continent are turning against any notion of war with Russia. So perhaps we should wait a little longer and the broader atmosphere will change to our advantage. So those are the two sides. And I'm not sure which one is going to win, but I think there's a lot of strength right now behind the first party. And I think Prigozhin, for instance, represented that viewpoint. And there are many people in Moscow that share that attitude. Enough is enough. Stop the nonsense. Put this to bed. Destroy this regime in Kiev. Because if you don't, the Americans and their allies will keep coming back and pouring more aid, more cash, more equipment, and more weapons into this disaster.
Final question. We have 4 minutes. What will, after 200 years of peace and non-alliance and a strong consensus of not joining NATO, Swedish politicians bought by globalists just overnight changed their stance and applied for NATO membership. And I think this has a lot of support, even though there was no referendum, because of the constant propaganda and the Cold War mentality that's still strong. What will a NATO membership mean for Sweden? Will we become more safe? Will we get free defense from the US?
Well, my first question to the Swedes would be the following. Has neutrality harmed Sweden? I think that's the number one question. Before you leap into a military alliance with powers on the continent, has your neutrality harmed you? I don't think it has. I think the Swedes are viewed as having been very smart to have distanced themselves from the forces that led to the two most destructive wars in world history. So, in that sense, I can't imagine any benefit to abandoning neutrality. I would say the same thing to the Finns. My second question is, you are convinced that Russia is a threat. Where are the Russian armies mobilizing borders with Finland? Where are the Russian air forces building up in northern Russia for an imminent attack on Finland and Sweden? Oh, I don't see it. What is it specifically that the Swedes are convinced will be done to them if they don't join this increasingly divided and, I would argue, dying alliance called NATO? I think NATO is in a lot of trouble. I think when you go behind the lines, you've got plenty of military people at the top of NATO that fall into one of two categories. Category one, they all want to be promoted and want to be advanced, and so they tell the politicians whatever the politicians want to hear. That's most of what we have. But then you also have a lot of competent professional soldiers who are saying, have you all lost your minds? We don't have the forces. We don't have the ammunition. We don't have the equipment. It goes back to what I said before. We don't have the command and control to do much. Why now would you pick this time to turn Russia into an implacable enemy? Because that's effectively what you're doing. You're signaling to them that the last 30 years are meaningless. We don't care what you've done. You're evil, and we're against you. If you expect the Russians to put all of this aside and come to you with peace in hand, you're crazy. So I think the very thing that everyone said they did not want, which is a larger, more powerful militarized Russia, that's exactly what you're getting now, thanks to Washington and its sidekick in London. Is that really what you want? In other words, you've created the incentive structure now. You've said, we're all your enemy. Everyone is an enemy. And you've, you know, joined this list of impossible demands. Putin must commit suicide at noon on Tuesday in the on Red Square. If he does that, well, then we may talk. Oh, by the way, all Russian forces, wherever they are today in Ukraine, must all lay down their arms and sort of skip back into Russia. That's all nonsense. Doesn't take reality into consideration. Nobody would have done that in the 19th century. Disraeli, Bismarck, Gorshkov, none of the men who were thoughtful in those eras would have made any kind of demand on that scale. What they would have done is look at the situation and make the best arrangements they could, understanding that perhaps in another 10 years or 20 years, it would have to be more adjustments, but the preeminent goal would be what? Peace. End the fighting, the killing, the dying, and the destruction. And let's look for some satisfactory outcome that everybody can live with. It may not be perfect, it may not be permanent, but let's get in there and stop what's happening. Doesn't seem to be any interest in that. Why would Sweden, whose neutrality has actually been a model for much of the world, now want to rush and join NATO?
Och därmed tackar vi översten för hans medverkan i Radio Folkungen. Det blev ett litet abrupt slut här på grund av tekniska orsaker. Men jag tackar honom och han har lovat att återkomma efter sommaren.